This is Encounter on VOA. Here's Carol Castillo.
Welcome to Encounter on the Voice of America. On this edition of the program, Afghan President Ashraf Ghani comes to Washington. Hello again. I'm Carol Castiel. The contrast with his predecessor, Hamid Karzai, could not have been starker. On his first official visit to Washington, President Ghani praised the United States government and U.S. troops for their steadfast generosity and sacrifice after nearly 14 years of war. Former President Hamid Karzai was given to criticizing Washington and even on occasion comparing the United States to the Taliban. President Ghani was accompanied by his former rival, now Chief Executive Officer of Afghanistan, Abdullah Abdullah. The most significant takeaway from the visit, in addition to inaugurating a more amiable and mutually productive relationship, was the announcement by U.S. President Barack Obama that the United States would keep 9,800 troops in Afghanistan through the end of this year, instead of his original plan to cut that level in half. President Ghani had asked Mr. Obama to show more flexibility in plans for pulling out of Afghanistan to meet continuing challenges posed by the Taliban and to continue training Afghan security forces. Nonetheless, President Obama said the revised plans do not change the goal of a nearly complete U.S. withdrawal from Afghanistan by early 2017. The Obama administration is also asking Congress for financial support to ensure that Afghan national security forces can remain at current levels, about 352,000 troops, at least through late 2016. Well, for more on the U.S.-Afghan relationship and the future of Afghanistan, we turn to two distinguished analysts. Michael Kugelman is a senior program associate for South and Southeast Asia at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars. That's a think tank based here in Washington. And Sadanan Dume. He's a resident fellow at the American Enterprise Institute, and he writes about South Asian political economy, foreign policy, business, and society. And both gentlemen join me here at the VOA Broadcast Center in Washington. Welcome to you both. Well, Michael Kugelman, let me begin with you and ask you about the significance of this visit, not just the atmospherics, certainly in contrast to former President Karzai, but also the tangible achievements.
Well, I mean, I think you've already hit on the biggest substantive outcome of this trip to the United States, and that's the fact that we now know that Obama has decided to keep nearly 10,000 troops in Afghanistan through the end of the year. And that's an assurance that the Afghan government was really hoping to get. I think that there had been expectations for a number of weeks that it was going to happen, but the fact that Obama finally formally announced it is important. Though it is important at the same time to emphasize that Obama really has not budged from his ultimate timeline of getting essentially all troops, all U.S. troops, out of Afghanistan by the end of his presidential term. I think that really for political reasons, for his legacy, so to speak, he wants to say that he will have removed all U.S. troops from Afghanistan under his watch.
Indeed, and he's, of course, taken some criticism on that, and we're going to get to that in a minute. But any other things you would like to add with respect to achievements in addition to the extension of troops?
Well, I mean, I think that there was another big announcement, what's been called this new development partnership between the two governments that's essentially going to authorize about $800 million to Afghanistan, linked to very specific reforms on issues of corruption, rule of law, really important issues. And I think the important thing about this new initiative is it's meant to promote accountability in how Afghanistan uses this money coming from the United States, which has long been something that critics on Capitol Hill and elsewhere in the U.S. government had said there needs to be a lot more focus on. So I think that's important as well.
Turning to you, Sadanand Dume, for your take on the significance of the visit, why do you think this extension of troops that President Obama committed to is so important, and any other key results you'd like to underscore?
Well, first of all, I'd like to say that the visit was successful, but the primary success really is a question of optics more than substance. I'm not saying optics doesn't matter. It does matter tremendously in international relations. It's good to have a relationship that is marked by a certain graciousness and not by the kind of cantankerous nature that we had come to expect in U.S.-Afghanistan relations, especially towards the later years of the Karzai regime. That said, and as Michael pointed out, The substance of this is not dramatically different. We're talking about less than 10,000 U.S. troops staying till the end of this year. Let's not forget that not so long ago, there were 130,000 U.S. troops in Afghanistan. So this question of President Obama's legacy, there's a contest between two ideas there. Is his legacy going to be the president who got U.S. troops out of Afghanistan, or is his legacy going to be the president who left Afghanistan safe and secure? And it seems pretty clear to me that what he would prefer is the first one.
At the expense, potentially, of a failed state, you mean?
Possibly, of course. That's okay. Still an open question.
Well, turning to you, Michael Kugelman, to continue the conversation on that point, because there have been critics who said that the adjustment, while good, still falls short of what would really be needed to give the new Afghan government a reasonable chance of success. Because as you said, and we also said at the outset, that President Obama still is not budging on his insistence of withdrawing all U.S. troops out of Afghanistan by 2017. Is that problematic in your view?
Well, I mean, let's keep things in perspective. When the U.S. had 100,000 troops in Afghanistan, Afghanistan did not become a stable country. It's not just a matter of how many troops are in there and how many troops are fighting. I certainly think that we should not necessarily use these very ironclad deadlines as a determinant of what exactly is going to happen in Afghanistan. I think that ultimately we need to look not just to what the United States can contribute, but also to what Afghanistan needs to do. Ultimately, and I think it's important that Ashraf Ghani made this very point, that Afghanistan really needs to take ownership of Afghanistan. It's Afghanistan and the Afghan government that needs to take the right measures to repair the economy to the extent that you don't have Afghans desperate enough for a paycheck that they go join the Taliban. There needs to be enough done to deal with corruption so that Afghans don't see the Afghan state as illegitimate and see the Taliban as a better alternative. These are things that the United States can't do. These are things the international community cannot do. You know, having a U.S. troop presence in Afghanistan, regardless of whether it's 10,000 or a bit more, it's significant because it provides a psychological boost to Afghan forces. That's important. It's important that they not feel completely abandoned. So I think that it's important to sort of get away from the talk about how many troops are there, how long they're going to be there, and talk about, you know, the importance of Afghanistan taking responsibility, but also just understanding that having some troops there is important, regardless of how many there are.
Turning back to you, Sadanand Dume, no question that Afghanistan has to take responsibility ultimately, and the sooner the better. And it's great that President Ghani actually underscored that. But to this very point that Michael made, what about the so-called psychological boost or message that another deadline given by the president, you know, of, okay, well, we're going to let, you know, almost 10,000 stay till the end of this year, but don't forget, by 2017, we're all going to be out of there. Does this deadline invite, for example, another Taliban surge, perhaps, and instead of ending the war that President Obama would like to do, again, might invite more conflict?
First of all, I agree that, you know, there is great symbolic value, and certainly better to have 10,000 troops than to have no troops. But this deadline problem has been there from the very beginning of the Obama administration. I think the bigger mistake was when he initially sort of pointed out when he was increasing troops that he would also be setting a deadline. And now all that's happened is that the administration is willing to play a little bit with the details of it, but the deadline remains in place. What this tells the Taliban, whether or not there's a surge, I think sort of we'll let's see how that plays out. And there are many other factors that go into that. But it certainly tells the Taliban, it certainly tells people who have been enemies of the United States in Afghanistan that you can play a waiting game. These people don't have the stomach. They are leaving. And ultimately, the other side is going to win. And that message has been extremely unhelpful in the past, and I'm afraid it remains unhelpful today.
Sadanand Dume is a resident fellow with the American Enterprise Institute. We're also talking with Michael Kugelman. He's a senior program associate at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars. And back to you, Michael Kugelman. And let's take a look at how this so-called dual presidency is going. So internal politics in Afghanistan. Following months of political tensions over the disputed election results, the two main contenders, Abdullah Abdullah and Ashraf Ghani, agreed last fall to a power-sharing arrangement in which Ghani became the country's new president and Abdullah was sworn in as his chief executive. And so the two were here last week. How is the government formation going, and are there any impediments that you see within that that could perhaps, you know, stall progress overall?
Yeah, I really worry about the ability of this national unity government to survive through its allotted term. I mean, let's not forget that this is a government that Afghans did not elect. I mean, they went out, they braved Taliban threats last year to vote for their candidate, singular. They did not expect to have a power-sharing deal. And so, you know, I think there's going to be tremendously high expectations on this national unity government to get things done and quickly. And if they don't get things done, people will get impatient. And yet, because of this arrangement, because you have two very deep rivals, theoretically supposed to run the country themselves, it's already caused dysfunction. I think the biggest indication of that is that the cabinet has not been completed. There are a number of open cabinet positions, even, you know, 6 months after this government took office. So I think that's really something to be worried about. If you don't have a cabinet, you're not going to be able to deal with challenges, no matter how large or small they are. And, you know, in terms of the two of them, Ghani and Abdullah, getting along, certainly when they were both in the United States, they said nice things about each other. But in private, I think they still remain rivals. And there have been some rumors that Ghani actually talks a lot more to others, including General Campbell, the top U.S. Military official in Afghanistan, than he does with Abdullah. And that's a problem right there. You need to have better communication between the two top leaders of the country.
Turning to you, Sadanand Dume, well, it's bad enough that there are external threats, whether the Taliban or potentially the self-proclaimed Islamic State, which we'll get to in a minute. But what about these reports that the government has been hampered by infighting, as Michael Kugelman alludes to, and with President Ghani seeking to solidify his power and potentially sideline Abdullah Abdullah?
Well, you know, that's hardly a surprise. Everybody knows that this is a shotgun marriage. And, you know, the shotgun is wielded by the international community in this case. So the fact that they seem to be making an effort, at least in public, at least in Washington, to be gracious toward each other is a sign of hope. But I would say that all in all, there are fundamental questions in this arrangement. As long as they remain backed solidly by the international community, which says that this is how we want this to work, there may be pressure for them to find some way to make it work. But my analysis would essentially be the same as Michael's. This is very awkward, and we still don't know how it's going to play out in reality over the long term.
You're listening to Encounter on The Voice of America. My guests are Michael Kugelman, Senior Program Associate for South and Southeast Asia at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars, and Sadanand Dume. He's a resident fellow specializing in South Asian political economy and foreign policy at the American Enterprise Institute, from whom you just heard. And we're talking about the recent visit of Ashraf Ghani and Abdullah Abdullah to the United States and the future of that partnership. This is a reminder that our Encounter podcast is available for free download on iTunes. You can find the download by clicking on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com/encounter. You may also follow me on Twitter at Carol Castiel VOA and like us and connect with us on Facebook. You may also send feedback via email to encounter@voanews.com. Either way, tell us where you're from and how you listen to the program. Here's a shout-out to a faithful listener and Facebook fan from the Philippines, Delector Ida Alipongan. Well, back to you, Michael Kugelman. And let's talk about the strength and quality of the Afghan security forces, who will be mostly responsible now for combating the Taliban and other threats. Talk about the quality and the strength of the Afghan security forces and the nature of the threat currently posed by the Taliban.
Yeah, well, I think there's no doubt that the Afghan security forces have improved tremendously capacity-wise in terms of warfighting capacities over the last few years, thanks to training and support from the international community. I think there's no doubt about that. But certainly there are still very key deficiencies, such as intelligence collection, air support, that type of thing. And these are areas where I think the residual U.S. force is envisioned to help out and try to fill those deficiencies. But certainly, these are not forces that are in a position to fend off, much less defeat, the Taliban insurgency by themselves. And I think you need to move beyond war fighting capacities. You need to look at more basic capacities, such as literacy. There still is very large levels of illiteracy within the Afghan security forces. They have trouble reading maps and signs. That's not good. Drug abuse continues to be a huge problem in the forces. Desertion as well. Unless these types of very fundamental challenges are addressed, and the international community has tried to address them, with mixed success. Unless you deal with these issues, it's going to be very difficult to tackle an insurgency that I think certainly has remained quite strong, and surprisingly so, given that the Taliban is a rather fractured organization. It's when we talk about the infighting within the Afghan government, the Taliban has been a victim of infighting as well. And it has been heavily weakened by what's happened over the last few years in terms of what the U.S. and its allies have done. But it remains very resilient. It remains there. And it can depend on the support of other militant groups from across the border in Pakistan. The Pakistani Taliban helps it out. It's just a bad neighborhood in an area where the Taliban can depend on others to help pick it up when it's struggling.
Well, turning to you, Sadanand Dume, for your characterization of the quality and strength of Afghan security forces, which will bear the brunt of confronting the threat from the Taliban and the Taliban itself, the insurgency, to what extent have they grown or diminished? What are the prospects for defeating them?
Yes, I agree with Michael that obviously the Afghan security forces still have profound problems. You know, this is not about turning to the Swiss National Army overnight. On the other hand, I do think that they have shown a certain amount of pluck and fight. And we have seen from Afghan history in the past that, for example, the Najibullah's forces, which had pretty much been written off, had shown remarkable resilience and capacity. So I think in terms of their overall capacity, they're probably, if you had to compare them regionally, I would have a lot more faith in the Afghan national forces than, say, their Iraqi counterparts.
All right. Well, back to you, Michael Kugelman, to address a problem that President Ghani mentioned in his address to the U.S. Congress last week. He said the Daesh, or the so-called Islamic State, ISIS or ISIL, whatever your preferred term is, that they are actually posing a terrible threat to Afghanistan and other countries in Western and Central Asia, that they're sending advance guards to southern and western Afghanistan. So in addition to the Taliban insurgency, to what extent do you have evidence of this? And how worried are you about that?
I am worried about Islamic State in Afghanistan. And I think it's important that right before Ashraf Ghani came to the United States, he acknowledged for the first time that this group, its influence is rising in Afghanistan. But I think we need to keep things in perspective. I really don't think that Islamic State can do in Afghanistan what it's done in Iraq and Syria. I don't think it's going to be in a position to develop a presence where it's in a position to take over huge amounts of territory. This is a group that has thrived on exploiting deep sectarian divides that really don't exist to the extent in Afghanistan that they do in Iraq. But, you know, that said, certainly there have been a number of high-level Taliban fighters that have split with the Taliban and thrown their support behind Islamic State. And ordinarily, that wouldn't necessarily mean anything. They could do that and Islamic State could ignore it. But just in the last few weeks, very significantly, a top Islamic State spokesperson essentially announced that the group had officially expanded into a region encompassing Afghanistan and Pakistan, what it described as Khorasan. And in doing so, the spokesperson appointed several leaders of this new Islamic State presence in Afghanistan and Pakistan. And one of them was a former Afghan Taliban leader. There was other leaders appointed to this new faction that had been with different parts of the Taliban in Afghanistan and Pakistan. So for that reason, we do need to be concerned, but I don't think it's going to become like what we've had in Iraq and Syria.
Turning to you, Sadanand Dume, anything to comment about this so-called threat posed by the ISIL or so-called Islamic State?
Oh, I would agree with everything that Michael just said, but I would add to that that the Islamic State worries me also because of the idea. And so what I'm concerned about is that if the Islamic State continues to make gains and consolidates its position in Iraq and in Syria, the number of people who might sign up for a kind of copycat approach is extremely worrying, and particularly in terms of what this would mean for the minority Shia community, and not just in Afghanistan, but I also worry about the spillover effects across the border in Pakistan.
Well, speaking of Pakistan, back to you, Michael Kugelman, over there at the Woodrow Wilson International Center. What about the Afghan-Pakistan relationship now under Ashraf Ghani? Presumably, it has improved over the one between Karzai and Pakistan. But I'd like to get your take on how things are going right now. Is there greater military and intelligence cooperation, or do the tensions still remain between Afghanistan and Pakistan that could scuttle, a deal for long-term security?
Yeah, well, Ashraf Ghani took office wanting to pursue reconciliation with the Taliban. He wants to get the Taliban to the peace table. He wants the war to end for good reason. And he sees Pakistan as a very important interlocutor because Pakistan has influence over the Afghan Taliban. I would not overstate its influence over the Taliban, but it has that. So I think that's one reason why Ghani has really reached out very intensely to Pakistan, and specifically to Pakistan's army chief, who is the most powerful person in Pakistan. And I think as for Pakistan's take on this, I do think that after the horrific terrorist attack on this school, an army-run school in Peshawar last December, there was a desire within Pakistan's security establishment to try to work more closely with Afghanistan in order to try to get Afghanistan to crack down on Taliban fighters in Afghanistan who were likely responsible for the attack on the school in Peshawar. That said, I don't think we should read too much into these, for now, better relations between the Afghans and the Pakistanis. I still believe that Pakistan's policy of looking to the Afghan Taliban and its allies, such as the Haqqani Network, that caused so much problems in Afghanistan, that has not changed. Pakistan continues to see those groups as assets that can keep India, Pakistan's enemy, from increasing its presence and its activities in Afghanistan. I don't think that policy has changed. And so long as that policy doesn't change, I think that we really should not read too much into this recent goodwill and intensified diplomacy between Pakistan and Afghanistan. I see it as a more short-term effort to promote more cooperation to deal with cross-border terrorism. But other than that, I don't read too much into it.
So what does that bode for potential peace talks with the Taliban? What are the implications of that?
I'm not optimistic. I know there was a lot of talk about reconciliation when Obama met with Ghani and Abdullah. There's been a lot of buzz about it, particularly because the Chinese have recently got involved. China has taken on a surprisingly large role in trying to help bring the Taliban to the table. But let's face it, we haven't heard a signal all the way from the top, from Mullah Omar, the supreme leader of Afghanistan. We don't even know if he's still alive, quite frankly. But we haven't heard any indication from the top leadership if they're willing to move forward with talks. And even within the government, I think that Ghani has received a lot of pushback from key players who are very unhappy about the idea of pursuing a reconciliation process that would involve Pakistan playing a key role because of this tremendous amount of mistrust that many Afghans have toward Pakistan.
Well, turning to you, Sadanand Dume, are you equally pessimistic about peace talks with the Taliban? I mean, currently the policy is to try to defeat them. Are you equally pessimistic, particularly given Pakistan's role?
I think there's tremendous room for skepticism. It's certainly true that Ghani has reached out to Pakistan in an unprecedented manner. He has shown a great deal of goodwill, and it's very clear that he has more room and flexibility in terms of having Pakistan and Pakistan-backed forces such as the Taliban be part of the ultimate solution. But it's still not clear. Pakistan hasn't shown its hand. How much of this is a negotiating tactic? How much of this is a question of the Pakistanis rethinking and willing to climb down either directly or whether their proxies are willing to climb down from some of the positions they've held? So at this point, I think if you want to be optimistic, you can say that there is new cooperation and that does open up new possibilities. But I think that the disagreements that have been there for so long are going to remain. And with the U.S. leaving, the incentives for the Taliban to wait this out and rely more on their brute military strength are, in fact, increasing rather than decreasing.
And do you agree with Michael that one of those areas of disagreement is over the role of India in Afghanistan?
Well, that's one of the ways in which Ghani has distinguished himself or differentiated himself, rather, from Hamid Karzai. Karzai was insistent that Pakistan does not get a veto in Afghanistan's relationship with India because Afghanistan needs that relationship with India for its own development needs. Ghani has been much more sensitive to Pakistani concerns, but certainly there is a deep sense of worry in New Delhi that Ghani will kind of go back to a pre-9/11 mindset to a certain extent, even though I think that some of those fears are probably exaggerated.
And what do you mean by pre-9/11
mindset? In the sense of Pakistan having huge say in Afghanistan's relations with New Delhi.
Well, turning back to you, Michael Kugelman, you wrote an interesting article recently about the impact of these nuclear talks that the P5+1 is having with Iran on Afghanistan. And then there's an India component there. Discuss what you were talking about there, that this could have a potentially positive impact on Afghanistan.
I think that if there is a deal, a U.S.-Iran deal, I think that could lead perhaps to more formal, perhaps, cooperation between the U.S. and Iran in Afghanistan, just because the U.S. and Iran really have very similar interests in Afghanistan. They both want a stable Afghanistan and an Afghanistan in which the Taliban is not in control. It's been like that for a number of years. And Iran, as you know, it has historical links, cultural links to Afghanistan, particularly the northern parts of the country. And I think if there's a deal, it would make it easier, perhaps, to formalize some of this cooperation. But, you know, I don't want to overstate. If there is a U.S.-Iran deal, it doesn't mean that the U.S. and Iran will become bosom buddies, so to speak. It's important to keep things in perspective. But I do think that a nuclear deal between those two countries could bode quite well for Afghanistan. It would not stabilize the country, but it would help bring together two countries that really or haven't been willing to work together. It would bring them in a position to do some good things in a country where a lot of good things are needed.
Anything to add to that?
I would only add that this would potentially bring us back to a period early on when the U.S. first went into Afghanistan in 2002, 2003, where there was a certain degree of, if not cooperation, confluence of interests between the U.S. and Iran, and that might open up without, again, overstating or suggesting that the two countries are going to be working particularly closely together.
Indeed. And as we close, let's talk about this U.S. economic assistance package, Michael Kugelman. Both sides agreed to require the Afghan government to complete specific reforms and meet other milestones to receive up to $800 million in economic aid. And of course, the fact that this was an Afghan idea is also worthy of mentioning. So talk about what this economic assistance will be going for, and how optimistic are you that the Afghan government and civil society can absorb it and, you know, use it in a constructive way and also fight corruption, which we know is quite endemic.
I mean, certainly there's a lot of work to be done, and just by announcing this new agreement doesn't mean that things are going to change, but I think it is significant that this new economic package is very explicitly targeting or support for key areas of reform, whether it be women's rights, rule of law, corruption, and the like. And I think for the sake of the U.S. public, this is also very important because the American public is very unhappy about the idea of continuing to have their taxpayer money go to Afghanistan, where there's very clear instances of money not being used for the reasons that it should be, a lot of waste, and so forth. And so I think that it's important to acknowledge the initiative just for that very reason. And also the fact that Ashraf Ghani, on several occasions when he was in the United States, he thanked the U.S. taxpayer. I think that was a very nice touch. He thanked the American leaders, he thanked the troops, but he thanked the taxpayers as well. And I think that was a nice touch.
Well, the last word to you, Sadanand Dume, talking about this economic aid to Afghanistan. Talk about, to some extent, you know, what Afghanistan is doing in terms of economic development over the long run, because once again, military defeat of the Taliban or other threats in and of itself is simply not enough. The country is going to have to sustain itself. And we know there are many problems with corruption and continued opium production, and are they going in a more productive direction?
Well, I'd say there are two things about the aid package. The first is, of course, that, you know, it's targeted towards specific areas of reform. But there's also a sense that the aid program so far has not been owned enough by the Afghans, in the sense that a lot of it has just gone to Western contractors and not been sort of channeled through Afghans and Afghan institutions, and there's a real sort of renewed emphasis on that. I think that the corruption problem is a tremendous issue. It would be awfully naive for us to expect that this is going to go away. This is one of the poorest countries on earth. This is one of the most corrupt. And the general record around the developing world has not been tremendously heartening when it comes to aid money actually lessening corruption. But it's a step in the right direction, and you can say that the efforts are sincere, and we should all wish them well.
Well, on that optimistic note, I'm afraid that's all the time we have. On this edition of Encounter, I'd like to thank my guest, Michael Kugelman. He's Senior Program Associate for South and Southeast Asia at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars, and Sadanand Dume. He's a resident fellow specializing in South Asian political economy and foreign policy at the American Enterprise Institute. Gentlemen, thanks so much for your terrific insights.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Encounter was produced in Washington. Thanks to Anna Zalewski for booking our guests. Our engineer was Linus Rimkus. And I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Encounter on the Voice of America.